KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today, we actually turn back to a topic that we've discussed earlier on in the history of the show, which is really the question of whether technology is advancing the ball in terms of education and people's knowledge generally. And the topic for today really goes in that direction, as we're talking with Professor Mark Bauerlein, author of the new book, The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. Needless to say, this is a provocative and thought-provoking title, and we're going to discuss the title itself in the course of the show. For those of you that have wondered or taken a look and thought about why this show is called Hearsay Culture, it actually gets to one of the points that Mark raises in the book. Hearsay culture, at least in its derivation, was meant to elicit the idea that with technology, we don't have the kind of filters that we generally expect to determine the veracity of the information that we're getting, how ultimately credible it is, and whether and how much and whether we should give it weight. In that sense, like hearsay, the evidentiary concept where information or fact is offered out of court based upon the truth of the assertion, and the question of whether it can be offered in court as evidence that a court should rely on, like hearsay, we deal with that question in technology generally. So hearsay culture, as a title, was designed to elicit that idea that we need more filters than currently exist with technology generally. In The Dumbest Generation, Mark takes a very deep look at many studies that have been done looking at the question of whether technology is making younger people, the digital community, or millennials, as Morley Winograd and Mike Hayes would call them, any smarter. And smarter meaning knowledgeable as opposed to IQ. And Mark's view is that ultimately technology is not doing the job that we think it's doing, and he goes through a deep look at a ton of empirical data in drawing his conclusion. Mark's book itself is eminently readable, and there have been several books written in this area recently, but I found Mark's book ultimately to be not only the most accessible, but one of the most well-researched, and we're going to get into that research as we go into the discussion. By way of brief background, and I'll allow Mark to introduce himself more fully. Mark is a professor of English at Emory University, and he has worked as a director of research and analysis at the National Endowment for the Arts, where he oversaw studies about culture in American life, including the fairly well-known Reading at Risk, a survey of literary reading in America. His writing has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Weekly Standard, Reason Magazine, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and other publications, as well as scholarly periodicals such as Partisan Review, the Yale Law Review, Wilson Quarterly, and PMLA. In his book, and we'll start the discussion in a moment, but perhaps to set the stage, I thought I would read a brief excerpt from the book to give you an idea of where Mark's position lies. On page 234, he says, "The dumbest generation cares little for history books, civic principles, foreign affairs, comparative religions, and serious media and art, and it knows less. Careening through their formative years, they don't catch the knowledge bug. Their tradition might as well be a foreign word. Other things monopolize their attention, the allure of screens, peer absorption, career goals. They are latter-day Rip Van Winkles, sleeping through the movements of culture and events of history, preferring the company of peers to great books and powerful ideas and momentous happenings. From their ranks will emerge few minds knowledgeable and interested enough to study, explain, and dispute the place and meaning of our nation." Quite a provocative statement, and I think we can get into our discussion with that idea in mind. Mark, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you for having me on.
Mark, let's start off by way of background, and I asked this of all my authors. I mentioned your background in a bit, but perhaps you could talk a little bit more about that and how you got interested in the topic of your book.
Well, you know, I can go deep into my background. When I was a teenager and I wasn't a very good student, I wasn't very motivated by my classes, but I always did read a lot, and I enjoyed books, and I took them seriously as kind of a different world than the high school classroom or the high school social life. And they meant a lot to me over the years at that time. I would read books like The Brothers Karamazov, and I didn't understand a lot of it, but I felt a strong identification with Ivan Karamazov at the time as I was undergoing my own spiritual questionings at that time. So I think that just deeply in my own past, I did feel the value of books as a kind of resource for a lot of the common emotional and intellectual troubles that adolescents typically go through, and that these things really should be understood as an aid, a refuge, a reprieve, or just resources to help you understand a lot of the things that you're going through. That may be the personal background here. The professional background really came up when I went to work in the government and got involved in large population studies of cultural habits of people of all ages, but particularly young adults. And for me, the striking moment came when the National Endowment for the Arts, and I was heading the research office then, released the findings of the latest survey of public participation in the arts, which had been done in 1982, 1992, and then we did it in 2002. We released the results in 2004. And that survey just asked people about how often they go to the opera or listen to classical music or go to museums and read literature as well as reading books of any kind. And I think the most striking finding was that from 1982 to 2002, the reading of literature and the reading of books in general by young people plummeted. In 1982, 18 to 24-year-olds formed one of the most avid, active reading groups by age in the country. In 2002, 18 to 24-year-olds formed the least avid, active reading group in the country, except for age 75 and older. Now, this is a fundamental shift in such a broad and long-standing activity as the reading of literature, and it fell 17 percentage points, I should say, and that this required further explanation. And so I took upon this job myself to explore the meaning of this, and I went around the country and gave lectures to different organizations like the International Reading Association, the National Council of Teachers of English, trying to build up the research base on this issue, pulling in statistics and data from the Department of Education, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the publishing world, and so on, to try to answer this question, what is going on? And this simply spread farther and farther, and when I left the Arts Endowment, I continued this work, and really this book is the culmination of that process.
It's a topic that, as I mentioned in the introduction, has a lot of currency. There's a slow growing skepticism about how great technology is, and we're all familiar with the early phrases used about in the utopian world that we're going to enter through information being made readily accessible. And we're going to explore those ideas in more detail as we get into the interview. But I thought I'd ask you, because obviously you are a professor and you teach in the classroom, how has your classroom experience influenced your analysis of these questions?
Well, this is another factor that comes into play. What one sees over the years, I've been teaching for about, going back to graduate school or even undergraduate school when I was working in an elementary school every day, 5 days a week, all the way up through public universities and now a private university here at Emory, and one sees changes over the last 20 years. Young people are just as smart and as motivated as they ever have been. But what I have seen is a deterioration in a couple of areas, and this is really where dumbest comes into play in the book. One, one sees reading habits and reading comprehension skills diminish among the college population. You simply do not find young people with the capacity to sit in a chair for a few hours and focus on a book without interruption. They have a harder and harder time reading long works. Similarly, in areas of writing, they have a harder and harder time writing longer works, composing longer paragraphs with sequential linear development. The transitions are breaking down from point to point, paragraph to paragraph, or chapter to chapter if they're writing a long thesis. So in the area of verbal skills, I think we do see a loss. For those skills, we might call it slow attention, slow writing, deliberate, careful exposition. That's one area. The other area is a changing attitude toward knowledge. And it comes down to this. A lot of young people growing up in a world in which knowledge is there. It's right there on the screen. They can get anything they want to know with a couple of clicks. And this is one of the miracles of the internet. We have access to all the information, pretty much all the information in the known world. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is the best material. We can go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and look at masterpieces there. We can go look at old maps from the 17th century. We can go to the Smithsonian website and get all this knowledge, old speeches and books as well. The paradoxical effect of that is that the greater access they have to knowledge, the more they can use Wikipedia and other knowledge tools that provide quick and fast access to the things they need for their homework, the less they internalize it. The less they think that it's important that they keep these materials within themselves, that they remember these works, that they examine the meaning of Abraham Lincoln, not just for an assignment, not just for a paper or a test, but take it into themselves and say, what is the meaning of Abraham Lincoln to me? What do I think of him? Why should I memorize the Gettysburg Address? I can always call it up with a couple of clicks, not realizing that these should be the materials of sensibility. These are the raw materials of character formation. This is where you get your values and your beliefs, your attitudes, and your vocabulary as well. So the unfortunate consequence for all too many students, and these are bright ones as well, is that this historical cultural knowledge gets turned into information. It is material to retrieve at opportune occasions. And if it's out there, it stays external. They don't have to bring it inside themselves. And so I would say those two things, the deterioration of verbal skills and a lesser appreciation of the implications of knowledge. And that this is reflected in the fact that their knowledge in areas of civics and history, culture, fine arts, is abysmal.
It's a it's certainly in the way you describe it, there is some I think internal logic to what you're saying, even beyond your own experience in the classroom, given how quickly information is coming at people through technology, and of course how younger people use technology, which we're going to get into a bit later. I do want to kind of frame the conversation by talking about your title, because obviously the title is quite provocative, and it could in fact be off-putting to some people. How did you choose the title, and beyond the obvious, what ideas are you trying to evoke with a title that's literally the dumbest generation?
It's the title that is off-putting to people. I was going to dedicate the book to my wife. When my wife saw the title, she said, "Mark, I don't think so." So I lost that, and she winces whenever she hears the whole thing. The title is really more a provocation than an empirical description. I mean, I in terms of IQ, in terms of ambition, in terms of college attendance, AP course enrollments, young people are doing better than they ever have before. So on those measures, you know, this title doesn't quite fit. But I've been a teacher for a long time, and I've seen good teaching works on a range of support at the one end, encouragement, help, esteem building, encouragement, inspiration on one end, and the other end is challenge, criticism, and provocation. And the goal as a teacher is to get students from point A to as far down the alphabet as you can in terms of knowledge and skills by the end of the semester. And you have to make a choice, okay, which works best with this student or that student. Now, with the choosing the provocation side, that really comes about for one reason, and that is that too many students are in love with their digital tools. They rely on them so much. These tools are so personal to them. The tools have so much social meaning to them that we are in the realm of provocation. We have to get them to be more critical about the tools that have become so involved in their lives. I mean, when we see that high school students spend 9 hours a week social networking, that's the estimate of the National School Boards Association last year, and I wouldn't be surprised if the number's gone up. 9 hours on social networking, while 55% of high school students spend 1 hour or less per week reading and studying for class, we've got to break their fixation on these digital tools. Mm-hmm. Something very curious happened in the state of Maine 2 months ago when they got back the eighth grade writing scores, the state test of eighth graders for writing. And what happened was they looked at the scores and they found, wow, the rate of people who didn't score proficient practically doubled from the year before. This is impossible. This is statistically impossible for this to happen. And they looked at the responses and they found way, way too many kids reacted to the prompt. They didn't like it. They didn't argue against it. They reacted against it. Oh, I can't believe this should be said. This is totally wrong. That's how they reacted. Now, what was the prompt? Was it about religion? About sexuality? About politics? The kind of things that would provoke reactions? No. The prompt was, quote, I don't have the exact words, but this is pretty close. Mm-hmm. Excessive television viewing can be a hindrance to learning. Hmm. Unquote. Agree or disagree? Now, for most of us, that's a pretty neutral kind of statement. But so many of them said, I watch TV all the time, and it doesn't hurt my academic performance at all. Added to that, in 2002, the state of Maine gave every seventh and eighth grader in the state a laptop. And they have been telling them for years, the screen is a learning tool. The screen is a learning tool. They've brought it into their work, and so the state has been giving them this message. Well, the kids have bought the message, and since they are so much in front of the screen, out of school, they have no critical perspective on those screens. And I think that's what was reflected in those main writing scores, which they had to throw out entirely. Hmm. That puts us in the realm of provocation. And I get a lot of letters from young people, and they have a lot of four-letter words in them and 12-letter words in them. And I respond to everyone because this is a teaching situation.
Although it's nice to see them reading books.
Well, this is the thing. It's a good it's a good thing that they are offended.
Yeah.
Dave. One, yeah, they're paying attention. And two, they care enough about intellectual values to want to fight back. And I write to them, and I say, if they're really insulting, I'll write back and I'll say, look, 10 years from now, if you read this email, are you going to be proud of yourself? But we often get past that. Or I will say, look, I get a lot of angry emails from young people, and a lot of them are filled with substantive points. And I often end up conceding those points because they're good ones. Mm-hmm. But when you sprinkle so much obscenity into your arguments, no one's going to listen to you. No one's going to take you seriously. And when they see me write that, they come back in an entirely different register. We still disagree. Although, as I said, I often say, well, you're right about this. Maybe that's true. But the civil disagreement continues. And I think this actually plays into an aspect of e-communication.
Right.
They write that angry note filled with rage because they feel that person is not listening. I'm writing this to him. He's not going to listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just watch. When they get the note back from me that says, wow, he's really listening to me, he's paying attention, they change. They feel, you know, they don't feel overlooked. They don't feel neglected and dismissed. And I find that too much of their email communications have that kind of distance and the speed with which they can communicate, that it does prompt that kind of rage or just incivility, and you have to work to get past it.
And I think that gets us actually into looking at this cause and effect. In other words, is it technology that is creating this dynamic, or are there other factors? And we're talking to Professor Mark Bauerlein of Emory University, author of the book The Dumbest Generation, here on Hearsay Culture. You know, Mark, you've already gone through some of it. As I mentioned in my introduction, you look at a ton of empirical data. And perhaps you've already mentioned, if you have, you can tell me that. But if you, as you scour the data to support this basic thesis, what is, in your view, the strongest piece of evidence that you've been able to deduce to exemplify this problem?
Well, I can mention a few things, such as the NEA report on the decline of reading habits in leisure life. We can also say things such as when the Chronicle of Higher Education polled college professors on students today, 2 years ago, one of the questions was, are students better, more skilled, knowledgeable today than they were 10 years ago? By 2-1, the professors said they are less knowledgeable and skilled than they were 10 years ago. When they ask employers about communication skills, verbal skills of recent hires, this is by the National Association of Manufacturers, as well as the College Board surveys of employers, both in private agencies and public agencies, the evaluations are withering. Many employers will say that we've got to bring in more and more coaches to help people with basic writing skills in the workplace. In fact, the College Board estimated a few years ago that corporate America spends $3.1 billion a year on remedial writing training for employees. If you look at remedial course taking in colleges today, it keeps going up. Not only writing remediation, but reading remediation as well. And these are a lot of kids who graduated from high school and are going into that college, and the college tests them and says, wow, this student just isn't ready to handle college-level work. They need a semester of remediation. So when we add to that, to those disappointing findings, the fact that young people today have never written and read so many words as they do now. I mean, because of all the texting, the blogging, the social networking, and email and instant messaging and so on, they're processing more words than ever before. And yet, those words, those habits they form in those practices are not translating into better academic or workplace habits. And one has to pose the next question, maybe there's something about text messaging, email, personal profiling, blogging, and so on, that is actually contrary to academic and workplace writing. One of the things that one often hears the proponents of technological communication, especially in leisure life, by young people is how it is sort of experimental, it's non-linear, it involves multiple connections and networks with all the multitasking, and that among educators and apologists for it, they are creating a non-linear way of communication, and that this is a kind of liberation of expression against linearity, especially that required in academia. Well, when we look at the professional spheres, if you're in science and engineering, 99% of your communication is linear. I mean, or law. You might know this better than I would, Dave, but tell me if I'm wrong, that law work, legal work, is pretty gosh darn linear, and it's going to stay that way. There are very few spheres in which the development of linear communication skills is not essential. And that means being able to write complex arguments, complex paragraphs that move from point to point. And that the multiple communications, the multitasking that young kids do, and the highly accelerated and brief messaging that they do does not make them more flexible in areas requiring them to develop a three-page interpretation of a dense poem, for instance. Or, you know, in a history class, simply record the narrative, the sequence of events in an important historical episode. Now, if college teachers and employers start saying, wow, these new kids coming into our workplace, they're blowing us away, well, then I'm wrong entirely. And I'll say, as a side note, we want every harsh judgment in this book to be wrong.
Right.
We want this generation to grow up and become extraordinary and smart and eloquent and critical.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM with the author Mark Bauerlein, author of the book The Dumbest Generation. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station here at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. As this is a time where cash is tight, your donations would be particularly welcome. And you have a couple of ways to do this. You could either email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to KZSU's website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU using the very technology that Professor Bauerlein is concerned about, but I do urge you to either write a well-written but clear email or alternatively to check our website. And either way, I do hope that you continue to listen to KZSU. Mark, let's, as you get into this area, I think a question that I'm sure you've heard before and that I think the listeners might be interested in is, of course, the standard critique that is made, I think oftentimes unfairly, towards people that have anything other than a very glowing view of the impact of technology. So how do you respond, and I think you've kind of gotten to a bit of a response there just before the break, but how do you respond to the critique that says, well, Professor Bauerlein's just another Luddite who doesn't like technology and doesn't want it around. We should go back to the good old days. How do you respond to that kind of critique?
Well, a couple of ways. One thing I will say is that I'm highly dependent upon technology itself. I'm on email all the time, and I have my cell phone, and I appreciate all the miracles of technology that have come about, the ease, the convenience. And I realize my need for it and the pull that it exercises on me. When I'm in my office and I have to read anything more than 10 pages, I have to leave the office. I have to go over to the theology library without my cell phone, without my computer, and sit in a comfortable chair and read it, because if I'm here in my office, I'm going to check the email, I'm going to look at a website, I'm going to make a call on the cell phone. There are always things that come up after a few pages of reading, and that these tools have become so necessary to our lives that not using them when they're around after an hour or two goes by, one starts to feel, I've got to check in. You know, I've got to do something here. I'm getting out of rhythm. So I think that one thing I'll just say is acknowledge I never try to remove these things from my life and wouldn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other issue about whether, well, these are just alarmists and Luddites, and we've heard this before. I mean, a lot of reviews say, even Socrates complained about writing, and people complained about TV 50 years ago, and come on. Well, what I would say about that is this. The proponents of the digital age, the futurists, the people who say, we have entered an entirely new paradigm of communication, of knowledge, and so on, I would say, okay, you're making revolutionary claims about the transition we are in, you know, starting 20 years ago and now passing through Web 2.0, and what will the next thing be? Who knows? You are making revolutionary, radical claims about that. If you're right, then you can't say that the people who are raising questions about what is this radical new age that we're entering into are just alarmists, and that we've had them many, many times before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to say that people raising questions about this are just Luddites is to downplay your own claims about the significance of all the changes. And there's a funny schizophrenia that one sees among many of the people in technology, especially in the education world, in that they say everything's different now, and yet on the other hand, well, you're making old complaints, and the technology is just a tool. It's just helping us do things. And what really people like me and others who raise questions about the technology are trying to do is say, wait a minute, we appreciate all the extraordinary gains that we find from technology. We appreciate being able to look at op-eds all over the world every morning. But we also find that we may be losing something.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we may be losing is the role of books in young people's lives, the capacity for 17-year-olds to sit in a chair and disconnect, log off, without feeling that they are escaping or without feeling that they are losing some social contact that is necessary to them. I mean, this is one thing that we should probably get into,
right,
is the social meaning of those tools. But
sure.
I'll stop for a second and see if you want to.
Yeah, and I do want to get to that. And I think the way to get to it, to really what these tools mean today, is to kind of ask a broader question about this generation. You know, when we think about these issues, I think, and it's something I alluded to earlier, you know, the question arises of how this generation is different from past generations. I mean, we know that the technology in terms of social networking and instant gratification and the speed with which information is coming at people across the board is a new phenomenon. But we're still dealing with human beings. And so I might ask you, other than the technology or the interaction that people have with technology today, are there any other differences that you identify between this generation and previous generations? Because as you acknowledge in the book, you know, the idea of being a nerd or whatever other pejorative term you might think of has always been uncool, quote unquote, going back generations. And we see that over and over again. And there, in fact, I mean, everything from, you know, famous and fairly recent films that certainly are juvenile in terms of their direction, but, you know, movies like Revenge of the Nerds have, in fact, the nerds, quote-unquote, lugging computers around and building robots and all of these things. And we have a transition, of course, today where technology itself is not necessarily viewed that way. But I'm curious to know, I mean, what's different about this generation other than the technology that might go into an analysis of or an impact the ultimate conclusions you're reaching about the lack of inquisitiveness and the lack of leisure time reading and retention of information and knowledge generally about our world? Are there any other factors that you identify or think might be playing into this?
You know, the social factor of young people is no different today than it was 50 years ago. I mean, the American teenager was sort of evolved into an independent creation, you know, in the 1940s, and we did see all movies like Rebel Without a Cause and The Blackboard Jungle back in the 50s. What is different is the mixture of peer pressure with these new tools. And you could put it this way. When I was, well, first of all, the thing is to appreciate the power of peer pressure in young people's lives. If you read accounts of middle school and high school, if you go there and watch the way people, the way kids interact, it is an intense social environment. Peer pressure is a very powerful thing. For many kids, walking through the cafeteria is a gauntlet of judgments. And they feel the anxiety of wearing the wrong clothes, or if they have a blemish on their cheek, or if their hair looks silly, or they're singing the wrong songs. Judgment will follow. You know, middle schoolers will talk about the ways in which the other classmates are very good at finding your vulnerabilities. And when they found them, they'll never let you forget them. And again, this is nothing new. All the more reason, then, that it is important for young people, for teenagers, to have a place to go outside that social environment. They need not to be so caught up in one another, at least for some part of each day. They need to realize that the world is bigger than high school, that there are bigger heroes out there than the star athletes and cheerleaders. So that is where, in previous decades, we saw a real difference. I'm 49 years old. I would get up in the morning, I'd go to school, I'd hang out with my friends, I'd avoid the bad guys, I'd, after school, I'd go play a little basketball and hang out with them some more, and then I'd go home. I'd cross the threshold, the front door, at 6 p.m., and social life was effectively over. Yes, we had the landline, as it's now called, but I didn't think of getting on the phone and calling my friends. I mean, yeah, there were some kids who'd be on the phone all night, but it's nothing compared to the kind of contact they can have now. I would have to sit at the dinner table and listen to my parents talk about the household, about money, about travel plans. I didn't like them, didn't want to talk to them, didn't want to listen to Walter Cronkite talk about Watergate, but I had to. I had to overhear it, at least. I couldn't sit there at the table with my hand underneath the edge and tap out a text message. I couldn't go up to my room, flip open the laptop, and get on my blog and talk about the biology teacher to my buddies down the street or 1,000 miles away. There was a limit to how much contact I could have with other kids. I would think about high school, but I couldn't immerse myself in it to the degree that kids can today. I couldn't have a personal profile page where I'd want to post pictures of the party last week, or talk about what's going on with me, talk about myself and my friends, and gossip about others. So just having a part of the day in which adult matters came into play, adult conversations I had to hear, and I couldn't check out. And I went up to my room, and there were some games, there were some stuff, and some books, and that was all I had. Now, if you walk into a young person's bedroom, it's a multimedia center. It's a command center. They have multiple networks in which they can keep in touch with one another. If a parent says, go to your room, you're grounded, that's not being grounded. That's sending them up to hang out with their buddies in virtual reality. If you really want to ground your 15-year-old, say go out and play and leave your cell phone at home. So this extension of social life to 24/7 intensifies the peer pressure, the peer-to-peer contact, the absorption in one another. And Dave, the thing to realize is it doesn't stop just because they're not on the phone or they're logged off. There's a scene in this movie that came out last summer called American Teen. It's a documentary that follows four or five kids through high school year, senior year, in a high school in Warsaw, Indiana. Well, in one episode, a girl and a guy have hooked up and they like each other and she's enthusiastic and she sends him an email with a picture in it. The picture is of her topless. She doesn't know and he doesn't realize that he has this kind of mechanism in his email that bounces emails or the material in emails somewhere else. Well, another person gets a hold of this picture in 3 hours. Two other girls send this photograph to personal profile pages, email accounts, RSS feeds. I mean, it is masterful the way they canvas the entire high school network with this girl's picture. And they leave her messages on her cell phone. All of this takes place overnight while she's asleep. She goes back to school the next day, and it is devastation. Every kid in high school has downloaded her breasts, and they get to look at her and laugh. And there is nothing worse than this kind of abject humiliation in high school. And what is the lesson? Even when you're not involved, when you're not connected, things could be going on. People could be writing things about you, putting pictures about you, responding to your blog, putting a comment on your personal profile page. And if you don't check in, well, yeah, something could have happened. I mean, breakups now, all by text message. I do not think we should go out anymore. That's it. So when my students leave class, instantly flip open that cell phone, turn it on. Any messages? Any text messages? And their faces do not register joy. It's concern. It's anxiety. And only when they've checked in and kept abreast of things can they be comfortable. But, of course, that only lasts for another 15 or 20 minutes when they have to check in again. So this hyper-social sense, hyper-absorption, concern, consciousness of one another, this, I think, is terribly damaging.
It's, you know, as you describe this, of course, it reminds me of work that Richard Lanham has done a couple of years ago in The Economics of Attention and other books where we, where ultimately the focus is crowding out, as I'm sure you're familiar with.
He was a teacher of mine at UCLA.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, and Richard's, of course, known as a rhetorician, and his book was fascinating, and I was thrilled to have him on the show earlier. So, you know, being intimately familiar with Richard and his work, and the idea of crowding out, I mean, what you're describing, or I'll ask you, I mean, can this be ultimately a question of this crowding out effect, this economics of attention, that the attention is focused on these social networks? And if that's true, my question is, we're seeing now today, I mean, this show is being recorded on November 11th, and Google Bookprint has recently reached a settlement with the Authors Guild, which it appears at least to clear a lot of the legal hurdles towards putting something online that will amount to a, you know, Alexandria-type digital library. As we see that kind of information, I mean, literally books being placed on the internet, or we see the recent examples, at least from the data that's come out from the recent presidential election, of an increased voter turnout from young people, or we look at a book like Millennial Makeover, as I mentioned earlier, by Morley Winograd and Mike Hayes, who have a very optimistic view of at least engagement of the younger generation because of technology. Do you see hopeful signs? In other words, in the remaining, you know, 10 minutes or so that we have, do things like Google Bookprint and other types of applications and uses of the internet that we haven't seen thus far suggest to you that this is not something that is set in stone, that as the newness of the technology wears off and as more quality, quote-unquote, information or traditional information is put on the internet, that we can see a reversal? Or is this ultimately the final impact of technology?
Well, a few things. One, on many behavioral measures, young people are doing quite well. We have lower rates of violent crime, lower rates of illegitimacy, more college enrollment, more AP course enrollment, better attitudes toward parents and other authority figures. So we see a lot of good things like that out of the millennials, and people are correct to point that out. The big challenge for educators is to try to find ways precisely to make the technology that has entered into their lives into a knowledge and taste-inducing instrument. I mean, we have good behaviors out there, and we have this great technology as well that can deliver knowledge and information so well. So what is the problem? And it is, I think, this social factor among adolescents that holds the progress back. And we have to realize that this social factor is one of the most powerful things in our society, the way young people are absorbed in one another. I mean, remember, why should a 15-year-old care about what happened 60 years ago on Omaha Beach? They care about what happened in the lunchroom last week. Why should they care about, you know, a romance between Julius and Anthony and Cleopatra? They care about the romances taking place with their friends. That's where the real stakes are. I gave a lecture at the University of Maryland a couple of years ago, like 300 kids in the audience, and I was blunt. I told them the truth. I said, look, you guys don't know enough about what is going on a few miles away in the Capitol here. You are six times more likely to know who the latest American Idol is than to know who the Speaker of the House is. And the girl in the back yelled, "It is more important!" And you know what? In her social world, she was right. If you come in to the lunchroom of a bunch of 18-year-olds and sit down at the table and say something about Nancy Pelosi, people are going to look at you and go, huh? If you say something about, you know, about Britney Spears, you're right there. You're part of the group. If you come in and start using a vocabulary beyond the group's level, instead of saying, oh, that guy is such a jerk, you say, oh, he is a truculent boor. Well, people are going to drop their spoons and say, well, who are you? You know, where do you come off with this kind of language? So we have to recognize that the social milieu of 17-year-olds is against the acquisition of knowledge and a better vocabulary. There's always going to be this tension between the cultural demands of your adolescent peers and the knowledge that goes with adulthood, the maturity that goes with responsible citizenship. And there's nothing wrong with that tension. That's just natural. It's something that just we need to accept. And I actually find that some tension between older and younger generations is a healthy thing in a society. It is good for elders to criticize the young for their ignorance and their inexperience and their hubris. It's also good for the young to resent that and to say, you know, you guys are getting too rigid and authoritarian and old. That is actually a way for each side perhaps to curb its worst excesses, but also it makes both sides think. It makes both sides a little more reflective, and this enables a better continuity of knowledge and tastes and standards from generation to generation. So whether we can break into that social sphere, whether we can say, look, 1 hour a day, disconnect, put your cell phone away, put your computer away, go in a room, read the newspaper, read the op-ed page, listen to Hearsay Culture, listen to intelligent conversation on the radio, on the web. This is not about eliminating the tools of technology from young people. It is about eliminating the tools that are going to draw them so firmly into the grip of the puerile banter and juvenile gossip of their buddies.
But, you know, and again, we only have a few minutes left, Mark, and I take your point, but to push back a little bit, again, on this point, you know, regarding Google Book Print, I mean, clearly, you know, the advent of technology has not, at least it doesn't appear to have changed, you know, the fact that if you called someone a truculent boor, in the early 90s before the internet was popular, you very well might get the same reaction. And so it doesn't seem like technology's causing that. However, because I want to make sure that we have this discussion remaining time that we have, you know, getting back to this idea of technology being the problem, you know, we can look at Google Book Print, and let's go a step further and not just talk about applications, but talk about hardware. So Amazon has their Kindle device, which is certainly, you know, it's not the cheapest device in the world. I think it's over $300 the last I checked. But the Kindle device is designed to allow people to download books, cheaper than the traditional print version. And if, again, just as a hypothetical now, let's assume that we could make the Kindle a quote-unquote cool tool, okay, like an iPhone, okay? Do you see that the technology, for in that example, could wind up being the solution to the very problems that the social aspects of technology have created?
Sure, sure. And you know, the Kindle is it still is too expensive to have wide distribution.
Right.
But people who have Kindles love them, and the convenience of a Kindle once you do get one is extraordinary. I ended up having lunch with President Jimmy Carter a few months ago, and he brought his Kindle to the table, and he said, "Mark, this Kindle is going to save reading." Mm-hmm. And he said, "I can be in the mountaintops in North Carolina, and I can download Anna Karenina, you know, mm-hmm. from anywhere for $7 or something." If we could get young people to feel that kind of enthusiasm about these tools for what they can do in terms of books, ideas, and so on. Yeah, that's the goal. And the people who figure out how to do that are going to be the saviors of the education system, I think. Everyone is looking for ways to make the technology work to produce more knowledgeable citizens. And, you know, one can't predict. What you're saying is I think that the technology in the hands, particularly the social networking, it is a problem for young people. But one doesn't know what's going to happen in 10 years. I mean, who could have predicted in 1995, if you described Facebook to a bunch of people, well, it's this system where you can write stuff about yourself and people look at it and write comments. You might get a lot of people looking at you and screwing up their faces and say, "What? It sounds like a lot of work. I mean, I can just call people on the phone, right?" So I don't think anyone could have predicted, not many people would have predicted, the extraordinary success of social networking. 10 years from now, who knows? Who knows what it's going to be?
The author is Mark Bauerlein. The book, The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. Clearly, Mark, you've written a provocative book, and as I mentioned in the introduction, I particularly like your discussion of a wide variety of empirical data that largely support your concerns. For people that want to learn more about your work and about the book, do you have any suggestions? Where can they go?
We have a website under the predictable name, dumbestgeneration.com, and they can purchase the book at a discounted price through Amazon. Barnes & Noble is on there as well. So there it's available. And I've been actually giving many, many talks and interviews about the book. And it's an issue for people. I think everyone has feelings about technology and young people. They want to express them. I give a lot of talks. I started out talking for an hour. Now I talk for 10 minutes and turn it over to Q&A, and the audience joins in with lots of commentary. And so I think it's an open issue. It hasn't been settled about the meaning of technology in young people's intellectual lives. And I think it's going to be with us for a long time. We need more research. We need to build the research base on the issues. We need to follow the new advents and the way the digital natives are adopting them. And we need to see also what happens in the 2010 election. Mm-hmm. Will the young stick with their increase in voting that we saw a few weeks ago?
Well, I'll tell you, I would love to have you back on the show before 2010. It's going to be a little while, I think, before things like Google Book Print or Kindle have data to support their impact. But certainly over the next couple of years, I'd love to have you back on the show to continue this discussion. And in that vein, I thank you very much for joining me on Hearsay Culture and enlightening our listeners and for a very provocative discussion.
Thank you, Dave. I enjoyed it.
The upcoming list of guests continues to be amassed. I'm very excited to mention several guests that will be coming on not only through the end of the fall quarter on KZSU, but also in the winter quarter. Nick Carr, author of the book The Big Switch, that has a new edition coming out, will be on the show. Ned Snow, professor of law at the University of Arkansas Little Rock, will be on assessing copyright issues. Morel Hildebrandt, author of the book Profiling European Citizen, an editor actually, who has compiled several essays written on the question of how the EU has gone about putting together national ID cards and what that means for privacy rights and others. Andrew Luman and Wendy Seltzer will be on discussing the Tor project, the idea of Tor servers and anonymity in communications on the Internet, a somewhat controversial area. Professor Paul Heald from the University of Georgia Law School will be on discussing copyright law and other intellectual property issues. I'm very excited to have on coming up soon Professor John Palfrey from Harvard Law School and co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, who's written a book with Urs Gasser called Born Digital. Jeff Howe will be on the show next week discussing his book, Crowdsourcing, getting in the line of several other books that have taken a look at how peer production occurs in our society today. And Bob Wallace and H.K. Melton, who are both former senior members of the CIA, who have written a fascinating book called Spycraft, looking at technology in intelligence and counterintelligence communities throughout the globe. Additional guests are being booked. I will announce them over the coming weeks, but certainly that list of guests will put us not only through the end of this quarter, but into the winter quarter on KZSU. For those of you that want to listen to the show, you have a variety of ways to do it. Of course, you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can pick up the show and all previous shows. You can listen live on KZSU FM Stanford, 90.1 FM in the Bay Area, or by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu and streaming the show, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. You can also get the show through the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, through the RSS feed, or through Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes podcast page by typing Center for Internet Society into the search engine in iTunes. As always, I welcome your comments, feedback, suggestions. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. And otherwise, and regardless, I thank you for listening to the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. Have a great day.